I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Stefan Hildebrand first started filming the story of the AIDS epidemic back in the mid-80s. In those early years, his project led him to the red light district in Bangkok, Thailand, where he met a couple of American sailors on leave.
I'm from New York City. This is the best place in the world.
Right.
Why?
Is that got
you get anything you want here. Any girl was holding beer for me, rubbing my neck, doing my nails. I was like, smoking a cigarette there.
Are you not afraid of AIDS?
Wow. AIDS? The only way you get AIDS, man, is if you're a homo. That's it.
Think about that. The sailor says the only way you're going to get AIDS is if you're a homo. That's it. Close to 20 years later, the ignorance of that statement is dimmed only by what the AIDS epidemic has become. 40 million infected, still 3 million dying every year. The filmmaker, Stefan Hildebrand, has kept the cameras rolling now for almost 18 years. It's called the Face of AIDS Project. It's amassed hundreds of hours of film from dozens of different countries. Stefan is here today to talk about what he's seen and what he's learned. We'd also like to hear from you. How has your perspective on AIDS changed in the past 20 years? Does it still get the attention that it did when so many Americans were dying? Is it now a story of class and color and race in the fight to stop the spread of AIDS? And how do the individual stories help us see the virus differently? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The filmmaker, Stefan Hildebrand, is joining us now from a studio in New York. Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. What was it that got you started in the very first place making films about people with AIDS?
In the beginning, I started because there was a conference in Sweden, 1986, preparing for a world conference that Sweden held 1988. And I did a documentary about this conference in 1986 and met people from America, from Africa, from France, from Australia, and also people, HIV-infected people living with HIV. And I thought this was going to be a big epidemic, and I was very interested in it. And then I started a collaboration with the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. This is the institute that gives out the Nobel Prize every year in medicine. And they are very active in fighting HIV and AIDS, and already at that time, 86, 87. And we started a discussion how to do this, and then they asked me to document the epidemic for 30 years with my film camera. And to make a long story short, I've done 18 of those years and 12 years more to go.
Now, just a word to our listeners here. If you go to our website, you can find a link to the Face of AIDS Project. And there on that website, you can see some of the clips that Stefan has gathered over the year, pieces of the films that have been put together. I want to use the advantage of that to kind of illustrate something that we'll be talking about on this program. Because in 1986, Stefan films a Ugandan truck driver, a long-distance truck driver, and talks to him about his contacts with women. We're going to hear a little bit of that. Remember, this is 1986.
Doctors traced the progress of the disease, case by case, month by month, powerless to halt it. Outside, on the open road, it's even easier for a van driver. Like a sailor, he boasts of a girl in every town.
I must have a girl in Quito, I must have a girl in Dola, I must have a girl in Kabwe, I must have a girl in Saka. I believe so. And I cannot have one girlfriend to go with her wherever I go. Too expensive, you know. So I must make sure that wherever I go, I must have a girlfriend to look after me.
Now we zoom 12 years ahead to 1998. Same country, Uganda, only the film this time is focused on a 14-year-old young woman who has become the head of her household. Her name is Kevin.
Hello, Kevin.
Her name is Kevin. She's 14 years old. They said they have been living alone since 1993. She said the greatest problem is that she comes late from school and she hardly has time to dig food for the others. So they only work over the weekend. And as you can see in the garden, what they have is hardly enough for. You can see the food she has prepared for seven of them. It is so little. She says right now they have a problem of the house. The house is leaking and is almost falling on them. The brother dropped out of school after frustration when the parents died. So for her, she says she wants to pursue education and help these other young ones. But the problem with the secondary education, it is paying. You have to pay for tuition in secondary education. After primary, she's not sure whether she'll go on with her secondary, though that is her dream.
And there are many more Faces of AIDS on the Faces of AIDS website. You can find a link to that. We're at theconnection.org. Our number, if you'd like to join my conversation this hour with the filmmaker and founder of Face of AIDS, is 1-800-423-8255. And Stefan, you know, I'm listening to the voices, and I'm trying to imagine that you were looking through the viewfinder, meeting these people, talking to these people, doing it for the past 18 years. It must have been quite a despairing, sort of depressing experience for you.
If I had focused only on documenting the dying patients or people living with HIV and AIDS, it would have been a depressing experience. But I have focused very much on my documentation on all the doctors, the activists, the nurses, the aid workers, the youth projects, all these people that are trying to halt and stop the epidemic. This is my focus. And the creativity and the endurance and the solidarity of these people who are trying to stop the epidemic and help the people with HIV and AIDS. Having this focus, it is possible to continue. Otherwise, you know, you would have been too depressive only filming the death. But there is also a life and a hope in the AIDS epidemic.
I'm interested in hearing from you a little bit about what you have learned or what your own experience has been. I understand that there was a very young writer, an AIDS patient in Australia, who was a part of that learning experience for you.
There was a writer in Sydney at the Prince of Wales Hospital. The first one I filmed, this is early 1987. Before that, I had met only people infected with the virus, HIV-positive people, but not anyone dying with AIDS. This man was dying, and he had the skin cancer, Kaposi sarcoma, all over his body, and we interviewed him. He was very clear, and he had final days before he should die. And the doctor and the writer accepted me to film with my team, and so we interviewed him. And after the interview, he was very tired, so he slept. And we, you know, pulled together our film equipment, the sound equipment, and were prepared to go. And then the doctor said, "You cannot go yet. You have to say goodbye to him." And he woke him up, and then he told us in the film team that you have to take his hand for a long time. And I was afraid, because he was sweating and he had this skin cancer all over the body. And the knowledge in the world was not so big yet, you know. I was afraid, but I took the hand and I felt his hand sweat going into my hand. And I felt, wow, maybe now I have got the virus. Because the ignorance was so big at that time. And then we left the man, the AIDS patient, and going in the corridor of the hospital, and the doctor came after us and he said, "You don't wash your hands until you have lunch. Because if you do that, you should not do this film, because then you're afraid." And then he left. And we looked at our hands, and the sound engineer told me, "Please, Stefan, can we have an early lunch today?" And this was a strong. After that, my fear disappeared, and it was much easier.
Was the doctor right to be so tough with you at that time?
Yes, I think it was important, because the doctors fought at that time a lonely battle. They knew that you cannot be infected by touching or by hugging or by embracing the AIDS patient. But But still, the prejudice out in the world was, you know, if you even touch an AIDS patient, you die. So I think it was important for me, an important learning experience, and I understood much more of that it is not we and them, they, the AIDS patient, or we who are not infected, it's one together.
Though in those early years, there were some people, children, I think you filmed, and that even that was seen as somewhat controversial at the time.
Yes. You know, in the beginning of the epidemic, it was like three risk groups: gays and intravenous drug users and hemophiliacs in the rich countries. And then the epidemic in Africa was not in the focus of the media. The media focused on these three risk groups. And, I mean, in the beginning it was called the gay cancer. In the first years it was called the gay cancer, you know, and it was stigmatized. It was a lot of prejudice around the disease, and it took a long time to change this. And focusing on children who were not sexually active, it was, you know, it was being perceived as strange and...
maybe intrusive at the time.
Yeah, intrusive, exactly.
All right, Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. A chance to actually take that long-term perspective on the way that we have understood HIV/AIDS with Stefan Hildebrand, who is in the middle of a 30-year project filming the face of AIDS. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection. Stefan Hildebrand is my guest this hour. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. He is the filmmaker and founder of the Face of AIDS Project. If you want to get a look at some of the hundreds of hours of film that's been gathered over the past 18 years, you can find it through our website at theconnection.org. Stefan, you know, one of the things that I was just thinking about is, and I've spent a bit of time in Asia and Africa also covering this story, that it seems in many ways like each country has to discover this all over again. You know, it comes to India and the men there say, well, it won't be a problem here. I like to have, you know, many girlfriends. And the government says no, it's not a problem. And it grows and it grows. And it must be, I don't know whether or not that's your experience, seeing that people aren't learning what they could have learned, aren't stopping the disease in ways that they could have if they just paid attention.
Absolutely. It's a denial, and it's a lack of political leadership in those countries affected. They don't dare to brace it yet. And I think it's changing now with the epidemic coming from Africa to Asia. It's slowly changing, and it's slowly becoming a more important global issue than only being a health matter. It's a matter of prostitution, it's a matter of sexual education for young, it's a matter of women's rights, it's a matter of poverty, mm-hmm. it's a matter of distribution of health care among rich and poor people in each country. So this epidemic touches on so many aspects of life, and it's slowly sinking in, I think. You know, when I was filming first time 1987 in Thailand, I filmed the Minister of Health, Dr. Uthai, and he told me there were two AIDS cases in Thailand at that time, which was not a lie, it was true. One came from Australia, a drug addict, and another one from San Francisco, a gay man, and they were dying in the infectious disease hospital in Bangkok. And he told me, this is a Western lifestyle disease, we should not have it in Thailand. Today they have 1 million people infected.
Do you think he believed that when he was telling you, or do you think
Yes, I think he believed it. Huh. And because it's a denial, it's Thailand was a country, they never talked about sex, they had no sex education, and then they got a good political leadership in the early 90s, so now they have pressed down the epidemic, they have been successful, because they have been open-minded, talking about sex, about men and women, about reproductive health, you know, many of these things. And that's now a success story, but it was a catastrophe in the early 90s in Thailand.
When I listen to your Ugandan truck driver talking about I must have girlfriends in all these different cities.
Yes.
I remembered listening to an Indian truck driver say the same thing. I sit in the truck all day. I build up this heat. When my day ends, I must find a girl to get rid of this heat. That was the way he described it. It was his language. But I'm wondering if in your experience right around the world, the sort of arrogance or selfishness of men has been something that marks the spread of this disease.
You know, I would even put it a little more blunt. I think that the men's sexual behavior is driving the epidemic, not the women's, but the men. And it's very important to educate young boys from early on and bring it up to the surface and being open, and also to empower the young girls to demand their rights. If in many of these affected countries, if a young woman asks the husband to use a condom, the husband becomes angry and insulted. This has to be stopped. You know, I think this is the main driving force of the epidemic, is how men behave sexually from a very early age. This must be stopped.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Stefan Hildebrand is my guest. He has been around the world for the past 18 years with a camera filming the faces of AIDS. We're going to Framingham, Massachusetts, and Irene's joining us. Hi, Irene.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
Oh, lots of thoughts. First, I wanted to commiserate with your guest that I went through a similar experience about the touching of an HIV individual. When I was working at the AIDS Project in San Diego around 1989, 1990, and I need to tell you that I am from Mexico City. I'm a nurse. I'm a well-educated person. And when I took that job, because it required some of my expertise as a translator, I was walking around with a Kleenex in my hand, going to, you know, opening doorknobs and drawers, not touching people. And I thought, you know, I have nothing to do with HIV and AIDS except that I have a job here, and what is a nice Jewish girl from Mexico doing in this environment? Well, I learned my lesson, and I was open, and I realized that it is obviously not transmitted by touching and hugging people, which I later did, and a lot. And I loved working with the HIV AIDS community and with the gay community, to which I had no prior experience with.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a lot of it comes from knowledge and acceptance. And through the years, I also did some HIV testing and counseling. And I found out that part of the problem is issues with self-esteem. If, I guess I'm going to touch base with women and girls first, if we women and girls were empowered and felt good about telling other, you know, I'm going to say men in this case, I will not use your needle, or I will not have sex without a condom, and be open to talk about these issues that are very difficult to talk about.
Do you think, Irene, even in this country, which is supposed to be somewhere near the, you know, the leading edge of understanding what's going on with HIV, even in this country, is there, there's that kind of power?
If there is this kind of power?
Yeah, do women have that kind of sense of self-esteem now?
No, I can tell you that after leaving the HIV work because of lack of funding from the federal government, I went to a new type of study that it was called Education Now and Babies Later, and in that, which had nothing to do with HIV and AIDS. And in that program, I had to teach self-esteem to girls from 12 to 14-year-old in schools.
Yeah.
To say no to guys so that they wouldn't get pregnant. Do you think that it is absolutely workable that I will teach self-esteem to a 12 to 14-year-old? That has to start when the baby is born. You know, in the first few years of life, you tell the child you are good. What you want is you need to state it and feel good about yourself. You don't have to insult the
right
person that you're talking. So, no, we don't have self-esteem in this country, and we are teaching it way too late.
I wonder, Stefan, if that's your experience as well.
Absolutely, and not only in the U.S., but in Sweden, Europe, the same. It's and this is maybe a good thing coming out from the epidemic, from the fight against HIV and AIDS. It's to bringing up the potential of empowering the women in countries around the world. And I think that is empowering the women and teaching the boys to behave. And, you know, if you listen to much of the hip-hop music, the lyrics in the hip-hop music, they preach the same attitudes towards women in the lyrics as the truck driver in Uganda or the one you met in India.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring Bruce Walker in on the conversation now. Bruce is joining us on the line from Cambridge, where he is director of the Division of AIDS at Harvard Medical School. He's been listening along. Hello, Bruce.
Hi.
I'm listening to the descriptions of Stefan's Faces of AIDS project, and we heard some of those voices a little bit earlier in the program, and I think of them in terms of using it as a warning, using it as a memorial, using it as a something of a wake-up call. Does this kind of long-term anecdotal filming have value for the scientific community, the medical community as well?
Yeah, I like to say I really applaud what Mr. Hildebrand's been doing and the leadership that's coming from the Karolinska Institute on this. I think people really have no idea what's actually going on out there and no sense of the enormity of the epidemic. And certainly to film it, to have people hear the stories is really key to understanding what the challenges are that are facing us. I think for a lot of scientists that are working on this, on the HIV epidemic, trying to develop vaccine, they have very little connection to the areas of the world where the virus is spreading most rapidly.
So for people who spend their life looking through the lens of a microscope, this kind of personalizes it or adds a certain, I don't know, urgency or dimension to it that they can't get?
Yeah, I firmly believe that, and in fact, what we've tried to do, we have a research institute that we work on collaboratively with scientists in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa, and it's been very important for our scientists here to spend time there to get a fuller sense of the problem. Just to give you a little bit of a sense, we do studies there. Trying to understand how the virus is transmitted to some children, but not all children, by infected mothers. And in those screening studies right now, over half of the women that we're screening in KwaZulu-Natal province are HIV infected. That's just a staggering number.
Stefan, I just wonder, in your experience traveling and talking about the filming that you've done, if you find that the medical community scientists are also taking advantage of it as well.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that is happening now, which is also very important, and I would like to ask this to Bruce in Cambridge, and that is the importance of trying to help develop a generation of scientists in the affected countries. Because in the beginning of the epidemic, all the scientists were from America or Europe, and some from Australia. But I think it would be very important to try to help bring up a generation of young scientists with good equipment and training in the affected countries. I think that could make a big difference. What do you think?
Oh, I totally agree with that. I think that the part of the problem has been not that there aren't extremely talented people in some of these most affected countries in terms of their scientific abilities. The problem is that in order to get really advanced training, they come to Europe or the United States, and there are very few places that they can go back to on the continent of Africa to actually ply their trade because the facilities are just not there. In fact, that's what motivated us to build a biomedical research institute in the heart of the epidemic. We thought we had started there with a small grant from the Pediatric AIDS Foundation, realized that there were talented and committed people that were just missing an opportunity. And in the end, the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation gave us funds to help the Nelson Mandela School of Medicine build the first dedicated biomedical research institute to ever be built at an African university, and that now is a focus for advanced research that's going on, trying to trying to address issues that are particular to the epidemic as it's unfolding in Africa.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call from Provincetown, Massachusetts. Rick's on the line. Hi, Rick. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My name is Rick Ferry, and I've been an AIDS nurse since the beginning of the epidemic, and I'm also HIV positive. And my comment, first of all, is thank you, Mr. Hildebrand, for what you're doing. But what I'm getting concerned about, what I am so hopeful that this project can help, is to preserve the history of AIDS, because people are forgetting. Those of us who have been around since the beginning of the epidemic, we're aging. Matter of fact, I write an AIDS column for an online magazine, and I was talking to the editor the other day, and I said, you know, we should really do a story about the history of ACT UP. And this 23-year-old gay man said to me, what is ACT UP? It was frightening. It was frightening, and you talk to people, and to bring this more home into the gay community and to America, the young gay men who are out there, you know, using crystal meth, having unprotected sex, they didn't go through the trenches, and I'm hoping this film will restore some of that. I mean, they didn't...
That's the point, isn't it, Stefan, to be, to give the perspective?
Absolutely. And to learn from history, I think you're very right, what you're doing in Provincetown.
You know, and keeps on ignoring it. I mean, you want to hear something really pathetic? The Provincetown chapter of the Names Quilt Project closed for lack of interest.
Rick, it's a telling point. I thank you for your call. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Stefan, you've had your own funding difficulties over the past 18 years as well, seen places like the and projects and efforts like Rick's closed for lack of interest.
It was very difficult in the beginning to explain that I wanted to document for 30 years in spite of having the Karolinska Institute backing me, the project would not happen. So it's because the backing of the Karolinska that it actually happened. But I had to do films. I mean, like a result of the documentation, I had to do films. But my initial objective was to document for the future, for learning. But the only way to get funding was to do film for the AIDS conferences or for TV, or I did one for Discovery Channel, I did for the different international AIDS conferences, and then I could get a budget for each film and keep all the raw material. I didn't throw one single sequence. That's why I have 600 hours in the project today from the 40 countries that we filmed in. But it has been difficult, and it's not until the last 2 years or so that we have started to get funding just to go out and document and make it available on website and DVD and so on to the world free of charge. And the project is run by a non-profit foundation presently based in Stockholm, but we are now trying to get the project to have a chapter in the United States. That's why I'm here.
Bruce, quick last question to you, because I'm near the end of this segment of the program. Funding also fickle even for cutting-edge research?
Well, funding's particularly fickle for cutting-edge research because the most creative and innovative ideas often go a little bit against the grain. And so the big advances often come from research that's been very difficult to get funded. So funding on all levels is something that we struggle with. Right now, there's a tremendous effort to address the global epidemic, and we need to do research around that so that we can show what we're doing is really making a difference and enhance what we're doing. Funding remains short.
Bruce, thanks for being with us on the program.
You're welcome.
Bruce
thanks.
Walker, director of the Division of AIDS at Harvard Medical School. And showing what the epidemic is, what it has become, how it's changing, is at the very center of the Faces of AIDS project. Stefan Hildebrand is with us. We'll continue our conversation after the break. A reminder that our number for you to join us in this sort of look back and look ahead is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Stefan Hildebrand is with me this hour. He is the filmmaker and founder of Face of AIDS Project. And this hour, a chance to talk about his 18 years of filming and the 12 years that lie ahead of him in a 30-year-long project, gathering literally hundreds of hours of footage, not just the people who are infected with HIV/AIDS, but all the people who are working to try and help slow the spread of the disease. One of the Faces of AIDS, which you can find on the website, either through us at theconnection.org or through the Faces of AIDS Project directly, is a 19-year-old girl from Cape Town living with HIV, wondering about her future, hoping to live a normal life with antiretroviral drugs.
I cannot tell when I was, you know, actually infected, but I think I was infected sexually because I was sexually active. With another partner now who's HIV negative, and we are happy together. I mean, he's negative, he knows my status, he understands me, we talk a lot, and, you know, he knows that, you know, I'll die sometime, but, you know, life is going on, like, yeah.
Stefan, that's from recently, right, about 2000?
Yes, that's from 2000 in South Africa, and this young woman is still healthy, living, taking antiretroviral drugs. So still with the boyfriend, and that also is important because in the early stages of the epidemic when it was like a death sentence. You were infected with HIV, you were going to die within 3 years or so. But with the advent of antiretroviral drugs in 1996 or 1997 around, it changed. It was like a revolution, and people could go back to work and live. The problem was that in the beginning, these drugs only came to the rich world, not to the poorest. Now, the last 3-4 years, it has started to be distributed also at a cheap price in the developing world, the affected countries. And this young woman in South Africa is one of the people living with AIDS who actually take the drugs and can live.
1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina, and Lily is with us. Hi, Lily. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I have a first comment to make. I believe that I'm from Africa, and we're having lots of problems with AIDS right now in my country. And I believe that in the beginning of the epidemic, the prevention absolutely ignored the cultural aspect of the whole thing. That is, for example, in America, say in the gay community and the other white communities, the things that would drive the epidemic of AIDS is all very different from what would drive it in Africa. For example, the fact that a lot of women depend on their men for their livelihood. And also just the culture itself, how women relate to their men in terms of sex and things like that. And so in the beginning, they treated the epidemic as if everybody was the same, and if they all told us that you had to be more careful during sexual encounters, it was going to be enough to stop the spread of the epidemic. But that is not so. And right now in my country, people are fairly educated. Everybody knows how sex is, AIDS is transmitted. But it still doesn't work because they're not addressing the culture. They're not addressing the problems of women.
Lily, what is your home country?
Cameroon.
And is the disease there considered to be something that is still out of control or something that is beginning to be controlled?
I think it's still very much out of control. Uh-huh. First, because a lot of people cannot handle the way their past lives, and they think that if they accept that the disease exists, then they must have it.
So when Stefan was talking a little bit earlier on the program, Lily, about empowering women, giving them the strength or the ability or the self-esteem to control their own sexual lives in a way that they decide. Can you imagine that ever happening in Cameroon?
Well, I don't think that someone will have to give that power to women. I think women have to take that power. For example, young men in Cameroon, the younger generations, they're very careful. They use condoms all the time. However, people of the same age do not date in Cameroon generally. Women date men that are much older. And so these older people do not have the same relationship to the prevention of the disease. And so
I'm listening along to you and thinking, Stéphane, in your own experience, you have seen so many of these little cultural nuances that need to be made a part of this conversation.
And I think it's very encouraging what you say about the young men, the teenage boys in Cameroon being more careful than the older male generation there. And this is happening now at a global level because the young people in the affected countries, like Cameroon, they have their cultural influences from the parents, but they have it also from MTV. They have it also from a global communication from internet. And so slowly this new relationship between men and women that has to grow slowly out of the cultural setting, but it has to be changed. And I think also countries like Cameroon, so I think it's a hopeful sign with the young, but it must also be a political leadership in countries like Cameroon who set the course, who speak bravely about what's going to be done, that it is a problem, we have it, and we have to tackle it. And there are many political leaders that don't speak about it yet in the affected countries.
In Cameroon, Lily, is that a part of it? The politicians, are they talking about it? Are there signs, billboards, that sort of thing?
Yes, they try to, but like I was saying about the culture, women tend to depend on, my culture is such that a man takes care of his girlfriend, and that's how it's always been, and that's it's even been made worse by the economical problems
right.
we have now. So women depend on the boyfriend, so on their boyfriends to take care of them. So they really don't have the choice. I sometimes think they don't realize that they have a choice to say, no, you have to use a condom. Many times they're more afraid that if they do not accept what he wants, their friend might take their place and they won't have anybody to support them.
Lily, I thank you so much for your call. I'm going to go straight to Natick, Massachusetts for my next call. And Jane is with us. Hi, Jane. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a sexuality educator, a health and sexuality educator. I do a lot of work with Planned Parenthood in Boston and around Boston. And I've worked with them doing this fact-based comprehensive sexuality education. And one of the components with the high school program is to bring in an HIV-positive speaker. And it has been just a really, really fabulous, rewarding part of this program for the young people. And I've had reactions anywhere from people pulling their chairs back to asking lots of really good questions, and even some of these young people saying, what can I do? How can I get into medicine and science and find the cure for HIV? So it has just been such a tremendously rewarding part of the sexuality education that I do. So, so important.
I wonder if you use films as well in your education.
We do occasionally use films. Unfortunately, we're very limited with the time that we're given.
Right.
So we don't often have the opportunity to use films, but we always want to stay current and try to make the opportunities to use what there is available. We use educators from the Boston Living Center in Boston, and they're men, women, all different ages, backgrounds, experiences, and they're very open with sharing information and answering questions.
One of the reasons I asked you, Jane, was that I'd like to hear from Stéphane on how the Faces of Aid project functions as an educational tool in countries where it's, you know, where people need to see it. Can they see it? And we talk about people here being able to go to the internet and click on it and look at it. Those kinds of facilities don't exist in, you know, rural Cambodia and other places where people need to see this.
We do it in two ways. First of all, we had not had the funding yet to make the archive available in full scale through internet and DVD, but we plan to do that in the coming 3 or 4 years. But what we have started to do is to broaden the documentation, because I'm only one person, I have one team. And we have started to communicate with young filmmakers in the affected countries and giving them training and digital video equipment and editing facility, and also facility to create DVD in the local language. And our pilot project is in Cambodia, where we have a team up and running, and they are already getting assignments now. So they will be like self-funding within one more year. And this is the way that I like the project to go, to invite young filmmakers in the affected countries to document the epidemic, send a copy to the archive, but also use it in the fight against HIV and AIDS in the local setting, in the country where they are coming from.
Is that an important... excuse me for interrupting, but I was wondering if in your view that's an important part of what the project can bring to people. You were asking Bruce earlier if local doctors and scientists can get more involved in dealing with AIDS. And I'm curious to know if part of the Faces of AIDS is that you will have young writers and filmmakers and storytellers in these countries doing these stories. So it's not, you know, Stefan Hildebrand and his crew.
No, absolutely important, crucial. And we are going that direction now, because more eyes can see more things than only I can do. I was starting the project, and now I like to, in the coming 12 years, to, you know, retreat a little and give room for the young filmmakers to take over this project and make it really global, not only mm-hmm. based in Sweden, but really make it global. And I think it can be done.
You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And Henry's joining us from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Henry.
Hi.
You're on the air. What are you thinking?
I'm from Uganda, and coming from a country that was pretty much hit by AIDS, I have had a chance of comparing the Ugandan experience to the U.S. over here.
Yeah.
And I think here there's a lot of ignorance about AIDS among the teenagers and some grown folks because of the cultural sensitivity over here. I mean, things like condom, you just don't talk about things like condom in public. My first experience, when I came over here, I used to work for an AIDS information center over there in Uganda that was working on AIDS.
Yeah.
And then I came with a T-shirt that says, lifeguard condoms save your life. And then at my place of work, you know, the word was hanging out. And then my manager was like, Henry, you can't put on that. I'm like, why? I mean, it was kind of strange because over there in Uganda, people put on a T-shirt that says lifeguard condom. And then you find like billboards that says lifeguard condom, you know, save it well. But over here, because of the cultural sensitivity, people don't want to talk about things like AIDS or sex or whatever. I mean, because they think maybe they're going to be offensive to the public, to the kids. And just because they try to save it don't mean that kids don't do it.
This is interesting, I mean, Henry, because when we talk about the cultural reluctance to, you know, share experiences and be open and honest about it, I thought we were more talking about what was going on in Uganda. You're saying that your perspective is you come back here and people are less willing to talk about it here in this country.
No, they don't. I mean, they talk about things like, you know, politics and everything, but when it comes to things like sex over here, I mean, they talk, I mean... I don't know what I'm trying to say. They talk about sex the other way, but not as AIDS as a problem. You know, they mm-hmm. try to hide away from the fact that AIDS is here. And when I talk to some friends of mine, you know, in Uganda, you can walk on the street and you find somebody, you can even look at them and you know that they're sick, even if you don't need to have them take a test, but you look at them because you've been exposed to them. You can even look at somebody yeah. and you tell that they're sick, and they really are. But over here, you know, you can't tell because people eat so healthy and everything. Some people have good weight, and behind that, you don't know what they're sitting on.
Let's hear from Stefan on this, whether or not there's a kind of a Western snobbiness or a developed country snobbiness about this.
I think it is a Western snobbish a little, you know, and I think that this the Uganda call, it shows very clear that it is not only we who know the answers in the Western and the affected countries like Uganda are the victim. We are all in this, I think, together. That's very important. And Uganda is a country who is a success story because they have been They had the political leadership with President Museveni, and they had very good grassroots organizations among the people. And I think this too, to have a political leadership who dared to speak about it and say, here, okay, we have AIDS, it's a problem, let's do something about it. And then you have grassroots organization pushing the leadership further. You know, this is very good formula for success. You've seen it in Brazil, in Thailand, and in Uganda, in Senegal, many countries. And I think this Ugandan openness is lacking in parts of the United States too, because it's sensitive to talk about sex, and young people, kids can be offended, just like the caller said. And so we can learn in the Western world from Uganda, absolutely, and from Thailand, and from other examples. And this is what I would like to the archive to become, to show different parts of the world, to inspire people in Baltimore can be inspired of something happened in Uganda by watching the film sequences. This is like a goal.
I asked you earlier in the program if it's difficult for you seeing each country discover this all over again and how lives are lost because of that kind of ignorance. I'm wondering, in the places that you've been working recently, what worries you the most? What place in the world frightens you for the lack of preparation or the unwillingness to talk about AIDS?
I think the former Soviet Union, India, China, Indonesia.
You've just named three
big
of the most
countries.
Populous countries in the world. I mean, billions
of
people.
And the epidemic is moving now. It's moving from Africa to these. All figures from United Nations and World Bank shows that China, India could have an explosion. And also Ukraine and Russia. It's still, you know, in the intravenous drug using population, but they have sex with people in the general population. And that's the crossover point, that the intravenous drug users in Russia and Ukraine and the other countries, former Soviet, they have sex with the people from the general population, and then it's spreading. And in China, you have three epidemics. You have an epidemic among the infected blood banks, and you have prostitutes, and you have drug users in the southern China. So it's
a busy 12 years ahead on this project then, I guess.
Yes, absolutely.
Stefan, I thank you so much for joining us on the program. It was good to have you here.
Thank you for being here.
Stefan Hildebrand is a filmmaker and founder of the Faces of AIDS Project. Earlier in the program, a few words from Bruce Walker, who's director of the Division of AIDS at Harvard Medical School. A reminder, to see more about this, go to our website. We're at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.